Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today we get to speak about, I think we might get to ground this concept of circular economy through a very specific example, and maybe we'll digress a bit as well. But we'll be talking about the Icelandic fish industry to some degree. So I'm very happy to have you here, Thor Sigfusson. Welcome.
Thank you, Amit. Thank you.
I tend to start, or I always start these interviews with one particular question, and that is, who are you, Thor Sigfusson?
I was born in the Westman Islands, small island outside of Iceland. We moved to Reykjavik, which for me was a big city then, I feel at least, in when I was 5 years old, and I've lived there ever since. Of course, been traveling a lot and studied both in the US and in Finland. I worked in Finland, I should say. And so I've been living abroad for nearly 10 years of my life. Have two children, a wife, and pretty good life, I would say. Pretty good life.
And one of the topics that you've been diving into over the past, you're running the Icelandic Ocean Cluster, you founded the Icelandic Ocean Cluster, and you are working on a project that's called 100% Fish. So I'm very curious just to give, if you would give an outline also of that context, because I think that's where we'll be moving a lot today, maybe.
Yeah, I think maybe to give you an insight into sort of the history of that is that when I started my PhD kind of late in life in 2002, and was planning to work on an idea where I wanted to look at how small startups in a small country, fairly far away from everybody else, how they exported or started to become global. Had it something to do with the founders, their background, or their profession? And I found, of course, that in many ways, which was quite interesting, is that the founders who had been living abroad or studied abroad tended to be more open-minded. Seems pretty obvious, but at least it showed up. The other thing that showed up was that it seemed like entrepreneurs that were in the natural resource industries, they were a little bit with smaller networks of relationships. So it all had to do with relationship networks. And I think I've realized since that due to the fact that natural resources are always thought of as being limited, you will have people in the industry that are, of course, saying we don't need more competitors. We need to keep things for ourselves a little bit more than in other industries. So I saw quite a lot of, quite some difference between the people that were in similar backgrounds in different tech companies servicing either natural resource industries versus others. And it meant that we needed to find a way to break out of that silo in a way. Because what's interesting with fish is that fish is, of course, the beautiful protein of the oceans, especially if it's done the way Icelanders have done it with nearly 90% of all our catch being certified as sustainable by international organizations. We are actually saying that there is an opportunity here to take this fish and create more value from it. And that's where we started our journey towards what we call the 100% fish. And what I learned quite early is that even though we found lots of gaps and lots of opportunities to do better with the relationship network, meaning connecting fishermen with tech companies, fishermen with universities and startups, etc., I realized that there were not only small gaps in Iceland, but huge gaps in other countries where the silos were quite obvious, leading to the fact that there was these amazing amounts of waste, side streams that were not used, were used for landfill in other countries. And we thought to ourselves, we can help here. I think we've got a model here that can be of help to others. So that's how it all started. And yeah.
And when was this roughly in time?
The cluster was established in 2011. And soon after, we got quite a lot of attention from abroad. So we started our mission sort of with 100% FISA maybe 2 or 3 years later, I would say. And as I say, since then, it's been quite an interesting journey.
And you mentioned now that the initial question might have been around sort of getting more value out, or like, you know, reducing waste, so to say. And I know now that you've been very involved in circular economy initiatives and thinking in circular ways. When did the circularity kind of enter the picture? Like, was that a starting point? Was that already from the beginning, or was it something that you found out?
Well, of course, I was so much inspired by some of the leaders of some of the fishing companies that had been really leaders in the circular economy for a while before I came into the picture. But they had never heard the term. Some of them still haven't, but they are doing so many amazing things. So I think for me, at least, it sank in quite early. I was lucky enough to get in touch with and be quite close to Nordic organizations that were presenting a little bit larger strategic pictures and the issues that were on sort of on the agenda regarding waste streams and how to deal with them. And I think the concept of circular economy was brought more close to me in 2017-18, I would say. And that happened through a collaboration with Nordic groups that were sponsored by Nordic Innovation. And I got quite inspired by that, but realizing also that, of course, the term itself doesn't make the whole difference. It's the mindset of the people all around, and that's what's changing so rapidly as well.
You said something about how things were organized in silos and how those silos kind of led to waste. And I'm just interpreting that there's some aspects of the fish industry where you might be thinking, well, we're doing the fish thing and we're not doing a lot of other things. I'm wondering if you would sort of reflect a bit more on that, because I think that might be a generalizable sort of, at least I see that's a pattern that seems to be repeating as we are sort of, when we define too narrowly what we do and we stick very closely to what we're doing and we're not doing other stuff, or instead of finding ways to collaborate or maybe share the resource that we don't need, you know, this sort of idea of the one man's waste is another man's in ecosystems. One thing's waste is another thing's lunch, you know, where there is no waste even.
But I think this is, of course, what was kind of shocking for me when I traveled some of the first trips that I did, both to North America and to Europe, is that we had a much clearer picture of the attitudes, which weren't really in a sense, more than just lack of education, lack of knowledge. But just like Icelanders in the early days, they, of course, defined many of these products, whether it was shellfish in general, and then, of course, some of the side streams from the fish, which often are like 40 to 50% of the fish. The whole thing was just defined as waste. And I think that's what we've seen and are still seeing all around, but it's changing quite rapidly. And I think what has been the crucial part here is that we've been able to show successful examples of how we can create value for the companies. And I think we have to realize that even though people are anxious to do better with the environment, especially in an industry like the fishing industry, the many fishermen have been really striving. There have been cuts in quotas, and there has been more cost, labor cost, etc. So I've been trying to figure out how to sort of approach them given these facts, but because most countries are just telling me we need more, we need to catch more. But what we've been saying is that you might actually catch less and create more value, not only economic value, but environmental value, and of course social value as well, because many of these coastal villages have been suffering. And we have these examples in Iceland all around. And long before I came into the picture in the cluster, we had successful examples of small villages being showing connections made between academics and fisheries, where they have been able to create small Silicon Valleys all around, of where people now are, even there are PhDs working on creating chitin from the prawn shells in the northern part of Iceland in a small town called Siglufjörður. And they're now with, I think, 20 or 30 PhDs in this small town of 3,000 people, 4,000 people. And I think what we've been trying to do, and it's probably been my main mission, is to just take these examples all around, because these are the best examples of the circular economy, without necessarily just being talking about the term itself, but actually getting it to be close to the villages themselves and the people and the new generation. I've met so many young people that have told me that their grandparents were fishing folks, or their parents are into fisheries, but they don't plan to be on the boats. But when we've told them that you can actually be a big part of the circular economy and create value and interesting jobs in your coastal areas by bringing your education, which often is quite different from their parents. These are folks that have gone to maybe university studying marketing or product design or chemistry or what have you. And we have been showing them that there are people all around in Iceland that have done this, not least in the last 10 years, and created value, but also really interesting jobs that they are quite fulfilled with, because they're actually taking sometimes those side streams, no value side streams, and creating value for the circular economy.
Yeah. So let's just, I mean, if you would, what are the, so we understand that we have fish and fillets and things like that we would get out of fish. I mean, some in Iceland, it's a big thing with lýsi, which is sort of fish liver oil, which is something that people eat a lot, or like kids eat, and it's a health benefit. But what are the other things that you can make from fish?
Well, maybe take the example of the fish skin, which has been now, we estimate that the fish skin in Iceland created maybe around 10 jobs in the year 2010, maybe around that. Mostly leather manufacturing, the amazing company in the north was starting to do leather from fish skin. The rest was often exported abroad or actually became waste in the past. Now we have probably around 600 to 700 people in Iceland or all around selling or developing products from the fish skin. And this fish skin is, of course, quite an amazing protein, filled with what's called the collagen protein. And so from the fish skin now in Iceland, we are doing collagen protein from around at least 2,000 to 3,000 metric tons, probably moving up to 4,000 to 5,000 in coming years. And this protein is good for, has been shown to be good for the skin, human skin. Some indications have been with bones as well. Then we have, of course, as I told you, the leather, where we now have designers that are actually taking all kinds of steps to develop interesting products, whether there are shoes or bags or ties or whatever. Then we have, of course, the amazing company Keresis, which is an incredible story of where they're taking the fish skin to develop skin graft that are used for medical purpose, for people having difficulties having their wounds healed. This company now is, of course, one of the amazing success stories of the byproduct industry. And we are using that example now just to show what we can do. The fourth one would be the drink collop, for instance. That's with fish collagen. I love to tell the story that the most popular drink in Iceland now is actually made with fish. It doesn't smell fishy though, even though so that there's no fat content in the skin, so it doesn't actually, the fat content is where the smell is. So I'm just naming few. But the amazing thing is certainly we have good jobs from only the fish skin, from the cod mainly, that are creating these amazing jobs, but also are making sure that this doesn't become waste and become a part of a landfill. From there, we can move to the intestines of the cod, for instance, and the roes as well. If we take the intestines, there are now what was found out by a professor at the University of Iceland in the early 80s was that the enzymes of the cod had certain amazing abilities. He actually had nephews that were fishermen, and he looked at their hands and said, "Guys, you've been 30 years on board the boat. How come you have such soft hands?" The fact is, they showed no interest, absolute no interest in his suggestions there. But he started to work on it and found out that the enzymes of the cod, because the cod has such small teeth, the enzymes have qualities that are amazing for the skin. And there are lots of research now being done where now it's actually done using it for cold prevention as well, sprayed into the mouth. But what's interesting is that for all of us is that I'm only talking about one species here. And what amazes me still is that even though we have these amazing research institutions all around, large universities, and huge startup environment in many of developed countries, we still haven't done the research that needs to be done to figure out what do these proteins of the oceans offer from other species. So there's a lot of work to be done still, but we've just shown it that with the cod and some of the other whitefish species in Iceland, what we can do. What I want to do next is to take on the salmon as well. The salmon industry is growing here like in many other countries, and we hope that we can use this model, this way of doing things from the whitefish to do similar things with that here in Iceland. And there is a lot of interest from the land farms, not least, to develop products with us that can actually create more value for the coastal areas and the areas where these farms are as well.
I think, yeah, you said at some point earlier in terms of that you can fish less and get more value out of it. So you can basically perhaps move towards, because I mean, that's another, of course, globally, it's a huge issue in terms of overfishing and what we're doing to the ocean ecosystems and really disrupting ocean ecosystems. And fishing is, of course, a big part of that disruption. So I'm also wondering, like, how do you think about that? And I mean, even we've had some scandals now lately in Iceland with salmon farms and so forth, and like the practices that are there with sick fish and lots of use of different medicines. And you know, it's not uncomplicated, some of the practices that are also standard practice in the fishing industries. So how do you think about that balance between what you're talking about and some of the hard questions, so to say?
I think it's just endless battle. It's we've done definitely mistakes in our fish farming. We've though been much more like following stricter regulations than most other countries. But the fact is, just like what I think is so important is that we're seeing other countries that have failed miserably when it comes to open nets, salmon farming, and we've tried to learn from that. And I think we just continue to strive to do better. But there have been mistakes done, and people will figure out a way to. I don't think the way for us to go is to just absolutely say this is hopeless. We have new technology coming, hopefully closed nets in the ocean or offshore farming. But what we would like to see is that my disappointment is more that still with all the salmon farming in the world is that I feel that we could do much better with the climate and the farming, because it's a beautiful product with regards to that, but we're still throwing away a lot of byproducts. We're still exporting like heads and guts, not guts, but at least headed fish. And we know for many examples that the restaurants that are taking it in are then just cutting it off and throwing it into the baskets. So we have a lot of work to do. And I think we can use the Icelandic model to do better. And just to give you an idea, I think that's been maybe if we go back to the whitefish, is that we are actually showing now that one cod that's maybe, let's say, a 10-pounder or 5 kilos, maybe the skin and the whole, you know, if you just fill it and throw everything else away, you will probably get, let's say, $15 for the cod, the 10-pounder. If the Icelandic model is used, and the extreme examples where Keres's products are made with skin graft from the fish skin, and then the enzymes and the liver is made into omegas, we are over $5,500 to close to $6,000 per piece. Mm. And this is the extreme. But what I'm saying is that, and I think this will also be an interesting challenge for us, because my feeling is that as soon as we're showing this to fishermen and the fishing villages, it won't mean that they will want to catch more. They will be, like Icelanders, making sure that the management of these systems are as good as they get, meaning that we will follow what the scientists are saying in terms of how much they can catch. But at the same time, they are seeing that they can create more value from the existing ones. But to do so, they need to make sure that there will be fish in the ocean for the next 10, 15 years at least, because they have to invest a lot in new technology, new knowledge that is not going to be coming in unless they can show that the management of their resources is as good as it gets. And that's probably the crucial part of our success here, is that we have nearly, in all the cases that I'm aware of for the last 20 years, politicians have been following the suggestions from scientists on how much catch is allowed.
I think that's such an important point. And of course, like some of the work that I'm following has also to do a lot with sort of traditional values and knowledge that might not live in the scientific realm in that way, but also like this experiential knowledge of fishermen and fisher, like people that have been in the systems and know the oceans, and they have a different way of reading what's going on in the ecosystems that they've been interacting with. I think, you know, also to be able to create maybe a possibility with this increase of value that you can get for each caught piece, you might be actually able to move closer to what they already know is healthier practices for the ecosystems as such. You don't have to deplete them in the way that we're doing at the moment.
Absolutely. Now we're trying actually to take on, because I think our model has worked in Iceland. We've been able to, we took, for instance, one of the first examples that we did was actually with the collagen from the fish skin. My team here, with this small team of ours, when we established the cluster, I had students with me, and we looked into the opportunities with the fish skin, and we saw that there was this gap. There was still an opportunity to do collagen protein from the fish skin that had been exported mostly to other countries, either as fish meal or something else. And we started to do a business plan, and we showed it to the fisheries. And the fisheries said, well, we understand it. It seems to be a sensible way to go. So we were able to take that further and create with them a concept where they now have an operation, this factory, which has the ability to do around 4,000 metric tons of fish skin. Mm. So I think but trying this now in other areas is our challenge, because it's easy with the large scale, the huge amounts that we have of all these. You can imagine we have 200,000 tons of cod catch each year. 3 to 4% is probably at least fish skin. So it's like maybe around 8,000 metric tons of fish skin that we have only from the cod in Iceland. But if we take the other challenges that we have, whether it is farming or something else, we have a big challenge ahead of us, because we are never able to get them the amount that we need to do a scalable production. And it bothers me so much. I spoke to our Norwegian friends now about the possibility of doing more pork side streams from porks or other or poultry, and they honestly said to me, you know, Thor, the capacity that you have might be done in our factory in maybe 4 days. And we know for sure this is the challenge for a small country, isolated country now. How can we take some of these side streams that need the scalability to be able to be efficient? And I'm not talking about nothing being everything being with profit, but at least being so that we don't lose a lot and taxpayers are really getting worried that the circular economy is turning ahead into something different from what they thought. So I am trying to challenge tech companies to come up with smaller solutions. And also for us in the fishing industry, we have so many villages all around. Both we've been talking to people in Greenland and Canada and in the Asian countries where they have smaller catch and they need smaller technology. And that's one of the challenges ahead is to find tech companies that are willing and able to help out with that.
I think that's such an important point. Because I mean, if you look at also the trends, especially in sort of regenerative, if you look at regenerative business or regenerative communities, then this whole movement towards localization is definitely something that they are talking a lot about as one of the sort of design criteria for being able to live more sustainably. And interestingly, I also find that, you know, given the maybe not so much in Iceland, but in Europe, we have a lot of nationalism and right-wing sort of politics on the rise. And so it seems in terms of if we want to close borders, then probably we need to have a little bit more self-sustain. I don't agree with that necessarily myself, but there are several, I think, trends, very maybe ideologically different, but they seem to be moving towards this type of opportunity. So yeah, let's do smaller solutions.
Yeah, for sure. But one thing that I wanted to mention, Amit, and we've talked about this earlier, is that we need also to bridge the gap between the idealists and the investment world.
Yes.
And I think it's like, for me in the beginning, I felt like I got quite enthusiastic for many of the side streams that we had. And, you know, but I realized quite early on that that money talks as well. So we started, when I told you that we did a business plan already in 2012 for the collagen, there was a reason behind it. Sometimes I want to have more of these individuals and these amazing pioneers that are coming with circular solutions and circular ideas. They have to learn a little bit more how to talk the language of business. Because there's still in Iceland this feeling, which has been all around sometimes in the environmental space where I am in, of course, that people are saying, we're not really business people, we are more idealists, and we don't like numbers, it's not about numbers, it's about changing the world. And I'm saying to do that, what I like is when people are coming to me now with these ideas of profit with purpose. You know, that's probably, in my view, the optimal model now, because then you can continue to invest and continue to do things that can follow the trends and follow the new technology that's coming, etc.
Yeah. And like you were saying with the fisheries as well, the time horizons for some of these investments and for some of these technologies, there is a built-in need to sustain the ecosystems that we rely on to do this. I was really curious about one thing that you said before, because in a way you could say that, or I imagine that fishing is a fairly conservative industry. It's been around. It's a practice that we've been engaged with for a really long time. And you are trying to shift it in some way, trying to shift the perspectives in some way. So I'm curious about what are your main learnings in that area? Like what are the important components to being heard or to get people to come along? Or what have you learned in that?
That's a big question. But I think what we realized in the beginning is that, well, interestingly, no one had actually put up this fairly simple picture of opportunities, I think. So that was one thing for us. We just started to show what we could do and how many pioneers that were still in their garage in Iceland and had not been sort of in touch with many, what they were doing. Some of them had done well, but financially, nearly none of them, except the people in and liver canning and omega oil of liver. But as soon as we started to show what the display, what we called the 100% fish, people were, the media was quite interested. And I think it was really important to get the media on board early on. And through that, I always remember, and I've told this story quite often, is that there came these siblings to me in their early, I think they were around probably 17 or 18 years old. And they said, we saw what the cluster is doing on TV. They were displaying all these products that are coming out of the out from one fish. And so we are interested actually to go studying for you, taking a university degree that has to do with fisheries. And we were just really glad. This is not the only time we get people like that to us. And they went then away with some of the inspirations from us. And we said, absolutely, stay in touch. A few days later, a fisherman called us and called me and said, this was great. I thought I had lost my children out of the fishing industry. But now they're actually telling me you should do better, Dad and Mom, with the byproducts, and we can help you when we've done the studies. So since then, we have been really busy talking to new generation. The beauty with the new generation is that they are so green, but they have not realized often the opportunities that we have in the blue ocean system and the opportunities that we have very close to them in their own villages even. But what has helped us a lot now is, of course, the success story with Kerasis, the fish skin company, which is now worth $1.3 billion, and so other success stories as well. But I think that's one of the key issues for us, is to bring the new generation in. And that's why we've been really busy also with the startup world. And what's interesting is that the first meeting that I was invited to was a startup group, a group of 40 startups that were all in this one group, one room, and a guy who'd been holding, taking charge of the group, he invited me with others to just tell a little bit about my ideas about an ocean cluster focused on seafood. As I stood there and thought I had done a really good preaching about my ideas, I then said, you know, anyone in this room, and we're in Iceland, by the way, surrounded by oceans. This was in 2011. I said, just please raise your hands, those that are doing something related to the ocean. And none of them did. They were all into game technology in Iceland and brilliant things. Some of them have been quite successful, of course. But what is so amazing is that this was this black hole, and it still is. We have changed that in Iceland in the last 10 years. And we're just reviewing that now. We see now that we have over 100 companies, startups, that are like coming with all kinds of ideas. And now is a blooming time, of course, because the Kerasis investors are now have cast out and have cast to share. And they're starting to invest in new companies, and the fisheries themselves are saying, wow, because there was a fishery involved with Kerasis, for instance, suddenly there's money to be made in the greenest of all green, which is the side stream development, for instance. So I think we've seen this happen. We can use the media. We can use a new generation. We need to use the examples, the success stories, which are successful not only because of finance, but also because of the circular economy. And through that, I think things start to move. And this is what we're doing now we have a sister cluster now in New England, and we have several sister clusters all around, but the oldest one is now New England. And they've been working closely with the universities, bringing in university students to inspire them to look at new opportunities there. And they've been also fairly well published in the media. Now we got a really good article in Boston Globe, for instance, about the New England Ocean Cluster. And so I think the model is fairly concrete. But I should never forget to mention also the importance of what we call the hands-on low-hanging fruit culture, meaning that and especially I love it with fisheries, they just tell me, you know, what do you really want to do? I know you're talking, Thor, but what is it basically, where do you want to make a difference? And this has to be something, the low-hanging fruits have to be projects that are giving us some kind of results within, let's say, 12 to 18 months. I'm not saying full-fledged factories, but at least work that people will understand, will be the language of the business as well as the environmental groups, and will have a meaningful impact on either the coastal areas or other work that is being done.
That's great. So I was hearing you speak to the initial part was to maybe first, I mean, it's a cliche, but like dare to think outside of the box, but really the aspect of showing the opportunities to both get some attention, but also to spark the imagination and to inspire. And then the second sort of principle that I heard you speak to was this show, don't tell. Like, let's take a few steps and show that it's possible, and then we'll see. And then you take a few more steps, and then you gradually kind of move the ecosystem to show what's possible. And then maybe relating to what you said before was also to, but this is my imagination, but I'm thinking one of the aspects, because you have a different background, you can also act as this bridge builder. You can translate between different languages. So you can speak to the fishermen, they try to translate what the investors are saying to the fishermen, and then to the investors, you can say what the fishermen are saying. And there's a language barrier that you're eradicating, even though everybody speaks Icelandic.
That's a really good point. And I must tell you, when I was doing my PhD, which finished in 2012, a year after I had started the cluster, and my PhD was actually on how to build relationship networks. So it had to do with what I then started to do. But one of my favorite fishermen in Iceland is the biggest owner of one of the largest fisheries in Iceland. And I met him. I was really inspired by my own work, of course, my own research studies and ideas, how to build these relationship networks. And I was talking about weak and strong relationships, that how they are developed, and you know how we could use my models to inspire the industry to do better, etc. And he just listened. And then at the end of the presentation, there's Thor. I think you're onto something, but could you then, this was in Icelandic, could you now tell me this in plain Icelandic?
Yeah.
And this is where I realized when you talk about bridging, it is a big thing for us. And I think we're often realizing that academic world and the business world needs to connect better, have a similar way of speaking. And also, not least now, the environmental world. That space is so filled with all kinds of difficult words. And what sometimes has bothered me even in my work is that when I'm meeting some super specialists in circular economy, they will tell me, Thor, you're describing something that's not really fully circular. It's like you're not following the term absolutely. And I'm saying, well, we have to begin somewhere. And I don't want to tell a fisherman who's actually just trying to do his or her recycling of nets or whatever that this is not completely the way to go, because it's not completely circular. Because people are just happy trying out new things. And I think the first steps are so important. It's just, for me, I'm never going to meet a fishery in all these countries that are mainly throwing away all their side streams and telling them that the fishermen can actually become pharmacists, because they have no interest, they have no knowledge in that. They're afraid that it might actually make them further away from the idea to do something. So we have to begin, sort of take steps, and realize they're all not all going to be fully fledged circular economy members, but all these steps are beautiful steps that can make a difference in the long run.
Yeah, I love that. There's this there's a question, sort of, it's a philosophical question almost, but it's like, when does a meadow become a meadow, or when does a meadow stop being a meadow? It's like, if you have the meadow and then you take away one blade of grass, is it still a meadow? Yeah, probably. But then you can keep doing that. You know, each blade of grass you take away. In the end, you just have a mud field. But like, when did it stop being a meadow? You know, when was it a parking lot? You know, and it's the same thing when you shift fishermen. You know, when do you stop being a fisherman? If you think you are a fisherman, then let people be fishermen. And then you shift a little bit and shift a little bit. And then each blade of grass, something changes. And when you look back, you might not recognize yourself, but you still feel intact. You don't have to sort of take the leap and become a pharmacist, like you're saying. I'm curious also about this sort of the practical aspects of fisheries, because you're speaking of, I mean, one end you have the investors, the sort of those strategic business people, and the other end you have the academia, and I will also sort of put in the consultant sort of group, or like the people with the frameworks and the ideas and the maps in the academia, and then you have practitioners. I mean, that are actually people that are on the ocean and that know their craft, and they've been, you know, raised sometimes in generations with these things. I mean, how I don't know. I'm just still like, I'm on that sort of translation question, and like to be able to get them to meet, because it's quite extraordinary that you have been successful with that for the past, you know, I mean, now more than 10 years to do that. I mean, yeah. Any other reflections on like what allowed the coming together between these different parts?
I think now we have, of course, like we have, in collaboration with others, set up 8 sister clusters, ocean clusters in different regions, from Namibia, the newest, to Denmark, over to Pacific Islands, then to the US, which has been our biggest base now, with 4 clusters running there. And it seems like my suggestions have always been sort of the same, is that we need to have the leaders of industry with us. And that's, we could say that's kind of sad that we are actually saying there's vanity in this whole thing, in the relationship network building. But the fact is, we need to have them. Only if we get one. When I started the cluster, I thought to myself, as soon as I get the first one, I will be able to brag about that to others and get them on board, because I can tell them. And the person that I mentioned to you earlier on, the owner of one of the largest fisheries, he became, after I spoke Icelandic with him, plain Icelandic, he realized that this might be something, and he came on board, and then it became easier to take the next on board, etc. So I think, but we still have, and I still have always this challenge of bringing them, like, because people are busy. And so it's always hard to like come up with a way to not only get them to talk, but also get them into new fields. So that was the other thing that I realized, is that in the beginning, I was always thinking these seafood companies, after the success with the collagen factory, I always thought to myself, the seafood companies will have to be the leaders and the pioneers in taking further some of these byproducts. But what has happened since is that what was sort of, as I was indicating you with the leader of this one company, is that I had thought of doing it like top to bottom. But in the last 5 to 7 years, we've done much more with bottom up, meaning that we're trying to get startups, get people that are in the startup world to show interest in new topics, bringing the researchers in. They have more time often to spend, both the research part and the startup world. So through that, to get them to work their way up and talk to the companies and move further up to the highest level. That has become more of a success story. And of course, it is because we have now success stories. But I will always remind people that are listening to me that I'm not thinking that we've done the whole thing for sure. There's been a mindset in Iceland for quite a long time that has helped me a lot. So I feel a little bit spoiled. And I know that my friends in other countries in the seafood industry and the aquaculture industry are having much more difficulty in doing these things. First, I think the trust level in Iceland is fairly high. Whatever we're thinking about our nation, sometimes we think that there are so many problems here. But the fact is, the trust level is high, whether it's just because we are so few, and they're probably going to meet your business associate in the shopping mall next weekend, or what it is, I'm not sure. But I think it makes a huge difference. And I'm just saying, it's, even though this model seems fairly simple, it has not been simple for many of my friends to do similar things in other countries. Mm. And it saddens me often to find that even the people that are the innovators a guy called me up from North America from 2 or 3 years ago. I remember it always is that, and he was like telling me that he knew that I was like the connector of the sidestream world in a way, and he said, can you help me? And I would say, absolutely no problem. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing? I asked, and he responded by saying, I'm not ready to tell you anything at this point. We'll have to see. You have to sign like a letter regarding that, etc. And I thought to myself, I never heard from him again. I was very polite, but the fact is, there are so many silos. There are so many people in their garages still around the world with great ideas that still think and are afraid that these ideas will be stolen by others. The beauty thing is, though, that I feel that the new generation is absolutely different. They tend to just announce their ideas on social media and get followers, and then through that, they're building their teams, which I think is crucial. Instead of being alone in your garage, you're building your team, whether it is virtual to begin with, into more physical. But I think their attitude is so different from the interviews that I did with people middle-aged, innovators from the year 2002 to 2010, the new generation now is absolutely quite different. And I'm really glad to see that. I think that's the opportunity that we have, but we just have to help them with connecting with the capital world and also the academic world as well in many cases.
I like what you're saying about the bottom up, because I think, and again, it's this sort of maybe the imaginative work and like showing what's possible. And then also, again, with the culture of, I've been spending a lot of time the past 10 years in the plastics industry, which is also an industry that's been around for, I mean, it's not as long as the fisheries for sure, but it's like 50, 60 years, and there's a lot of set ways, and it's very, very difficult to get anybody to change or consider anything else. They're very conservative in that way. But then as soon as you start showing that something is possible, or start from another way, and you can actually go and talk about the machine in a particular way, or like you can signal that you know what you're talking about. So you show, don't tell, but then you also sort of show what's possible, and like you come with a solution or a suggestion, then it's much easier to improve on that initial thing than to just have them come along on an idea or whatever. I mean, because most, frankly, also, you know, most of the stuff has already been tried in one way or another, but maybe now is the right time for it to happen. And then, you know, you have to show that you can do what you say you're doing.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, of course, I think we've seen the major difference in these circular issues that we've been dealing with, not only, but in the past in the fisheries, but now in other aspects of the economy, is that the DNA of circular economy has moved through to all levels within the company. In the past, we were only seeing just the CEO having some kind of chat about it and maybe have it somewhat in the annual report. But now we are finding it in the canteen of the companies, all talking about possibilities. So it's a brilliant time for us to take these projects further. But I think our biggest challenge is to talk the language, the normal language of, you know, get away from the academic feel to it and the pompous feel of being the circular leader or whatever, into something where people will understand that they can be a part of it and they don't have to be afraid of sort of talking their own language than when they're talking about the environment.
Yeah, I like that. And I mean, you've said it to me a couple of times as well. It's like, you know, is it the idea that you like, or do you actually want something to get done? And not that they have to be opposed to one another, but, you know, if the getting something done is above the idea, then like you're saying, then maybe don't keep it in the garage. Just go out and see who wants to improve it and who wants to move it. And even if it's an imperfect solution, then try it on and you see what worked and what didn't work, and then you change and then you iterate, and all of a sudden you have a 5,000 ton collagen factory on your hands that's successful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there something else from your side that, in terms of this pending shift that the world seems to have to do, maybe from business as usual to something more sustainable or circular or regenerative, whatever sort of framework you fit that in under. Is there something other that you have noticed in trying to invite people into this new possibility or like this new future that you've been working with for a long time?
I had a really interesting discussion the other day with a group of very talented people in this field and very experienced people in this field. And I asked them all about, we had like certain particular questions to be addressed. I was like chairing the table, and we went around and we were talking about like, where are we now with the circular economy in Iceland and where can we be, etc. And I felt a little bit that we were all kind of negative towards like where it is going. And we started to discuss, because I was kind of upfront saying that my strategy has most of the time been using sort of positive signals, talking more about success stories where people have actually made the difference and are helping out, rather than focusing on the problems. And I think we had a really good discussion, and one person there particularly, she just said we have to have both, definitely. And I think, but I think sometimes we've been leaving out the positive messages, because I think, at least in Iceland, I think we've done well by saying, like, as I've indicated to you, if I show successful fishery that has been really green, has been doing circular economy, it will inspire others, not least the children of other fishermen that will ask mom and dad, what are you doing? Are you doing similar things as this fishery here? So this is sort of the, as we have approached this in this positive manner. And I think it, I'm not trying to be unrealistic, but I think the mixture of both is important. I think we have to address the problem. We have to get people to face the fact that things are not moving as fast as they can. But we should also always try to find ways to talk about the success stories and how they are making a difference. And I feel a little bit that that is still a missing puzzle for many of our circular economy friends, that they, but they may be right. I am not sure. I've at least used this and it's been successful in my case. And I have, of course, so many successful examples, not only in Iceland. We have really interesting examples now in the US and Canada and Norway and all around, people that are really doing things. And what's interesting is that in this industry, just like they're in silos, they are not even talking about it. They still don't know what a circular economy is. They haven't heard the term, but they're doing amazing things with, whether it is the prawn shells in Iceland or the lobster shells that are wasted in most countries being changed into amazing skincare products in the US and over to Norway, where they are doing now omega fish oil from salmon, herring, etc. So there are so many good examples. And my feeling is that we need to talk about that much more. But I may also be a little bit blinded about how important the negative message is. I shouldn't say negative, but the rational message, which is, of course, we're just not moving fast enough.
I agree with your with the person at that discussion that it's both. But I kind of tend to think about it as a lot of the stuff that you're doing is inspiration and imagination and like sparking the possibility so that you start looking towards something. But then once you really feel that possible future or feel that, that possibility, like what you could do, then I think it's really important. And that's where I think sometimes the startup world gets a little bit caught up. Then it's really important to look at what is. Because like you were saying, like if you don't come to the investors with something that fits into their world, they're just going to say, you're a dreamer. We're never going to fund you. So you have to be, you know, caught like, filled up with your possibility, and that's the sort of the first step. But then we have to look at what are the structures and what are the things that we are that's currently holding us back. And I think especially for the younger generation, where if you have a fishery, like then you have traditions and habits and things that you've done in a certain way. And from having run the family business, you know, we were only 10 people. It's a small company. we're doing very innovative stuff, but to change any habit, everybody has to be on board. And it's not so easy sometimes for your father, especially if you're working with your father or your parents or whatever, you know, to have that conversation. So I think I agree, it's both. It's like you have to look at the world as it is, as closely as you can, and you have to be able to dream and imagine and like live in the future.
And I must just emphasize, we have been telling people how much waste is out there. And can you just imagine? We know now if we take discards and we take the waste in the processing and the consumer waste, discards meaning that the fisherman is actually saying this fish is too small, often dead, but you throw it off board into the sea again. We're talking about probably around 60 million metric tons. And just to give you an idea, I mean, 60 million metric tons, I hate these numbers because they are too high. 60 million metric tons is like 60 billion kilos. This means that we might have around, let's say, 150 to 200 million meals that we could feed quite a lot of mouths that need feeding from fish that is thrown away, not processed properly, or by consumers not used. And it's kind of sad because it shows us as well how long we have to go still. But we're taking it in my work. We're taking now 1 million. We're taking 1 million tons with our friends both in the U.S. and in Portugal and in Korea now, and helping them to figure out a way to do better. And some of the best examples now are from the Great Lakes in the U.S. where they are just becoming really enthusiastic to say we can do better. And what I love with their work is that they're actually getting the fishermen on board. And so they are actually themselves saying we can do better with these proteins. But just to emphasize, these numbers are amazing. And they mean that we need to announce them, but then start talking about the people that are making the difference already.
Great. If people want to find out more about the 100% Fish project or the work that the Ocean Cluster is doing, or start up their own Ocean Cluster or get affiliated in some way, where can they find you?
Yeah, we have a website, just oceancluster.is. So I think that would be the easiest way. We'd love to have people visit our facility here in the Reykjavik port, called the Ocean Cluster House, where we have around 150 people and around 60 to 70 startups and small companies and large companies together, creating this community. My dream is actually to have more of these facilities. We have already now a facility like that in Maine, and we're seeing others showing interest. But I think what is so amazing is that we've seen that the physical space has a meaning here. Just to get people to meet at the coffee machine here in the Ocean Cluster House has meant that we've created value. So both visiting us here, looking at our website, we would be honored to have comments, thoughts, and ideas, not least from people that are interested in taking the circular seafood world in their own hands, in their own regions.
Beautiful. Yeah, the link will be clickable in the show notes as well. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Amit, and thanks for your work. We have noticed your work in Iceland, and I hope you will do more with us. You've been a great help.
Yeah, it's a good beginning, right?
Yeah.